Chinese in Japan or Koreans in Korea. Had the Philly and Free Mumia with the Kuji Chagalia true. Singing and swinging and writing.
We're about to have a conversation with Sherilyn Ifill, who, of course, is the president and director general of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Sherilyn, welcome. Good to have you with us, as always.
Thank you, Mark.
So we've covered the Gorsuch hearings and this week a little bit in the beginning of the week. But I was really taken by the things you put out at LDF on mm-hmm. this particular case and this particular judge. I mean, first of all, one of the things that strikes me here, and I see what you think about this, that this is, we're talking about a justice who, if he becomes justice, and most likely will become justice and confirmed, is an awful lot like Scalia, but much younger. And he could really restore the conservative tilt on this court that could endure for decades.
Well, I don't think there's any question but that whoever the current president nominates will restore the conservative balance of the court. He's not going to nominate a liberal. And that's
no.
part of why what happened to Judge Garland is so devastating. And actually, I shouldn't say what happened to Judge Garland. I should say what happened to this country, what happened to the balance of institutional power, what happened to respect for the presidency of President Barack Obama, the disrespectful action that was taken as kind of the final, the finishing touch on 8 years of disrespect toward President Obama is so significant because he was essentially kept from being able to exercise his presidential authority to name someone to the seat that was vacated after the death of Justice Scalia. And it was done for the express purpose of rolling the dice on the possibility that the Democratic nominee for president would not win, the Republican nominee would win. At that time, it was the February when Justice Scalia passed away. We didn't know who the nominees would be from either party, to be frank. But Senator Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader of the Republicans, declared within hours of Justice Scalia's death that he would not allow a hearing on any person that President Obama nominated. And that is really what ensured that the balance of the court would not change. And then, of course, the outcome of the election turned out to be what it was. And I think that was a surprise to everyone, Republicans included. But it was a roll of the dice that Mitch McConnell took, and he was successful in his gamble. And now we're in the situation where the new president, Mr. Trump, gets to nominate someone to the Supreme Court. And the person that he nominated was Neil Gorsuch. And that's separate and apart from the fact that Neil Gorsuch's own record is so deeply troubling. And so at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, we did a report, as we do on every Supreme Court nominee. We did a report on Judge Garland. We've done reports on Sotomayor and Kagan and others who've become justices. But when a Supreme Court justice is nominated, we do a full review of their record through the lens of civil rights. People are looking at many other things. They're looking at the First Amendment. They're looking at all kinds of issues. But we offer a report that looks at the civil rights record of whoever the nominee is. And so we did one for Judge Gorsuch. We read over 900 opinions. We read all of the articles that he's written. And we issued a 70-page report, which you can find on our website, www.naacplbf.org. You could also just read the summary if you don't want to read all the 70 pages. But based on his record, we chose to oppose his confirmation to the Supreme Court.
Well, I did read that report. And so let's talk about some of these things that about the civil rights cases in the past and where he stands on things. I mean, as we're talking now, at any moment they'll be talking about the Shelby case and voting rights, Shelby v. Holder. So give us your analysis of some of the key points with voting rights, the civil rights law itself, what you found when it came to Judge Gorsuch.
So I'd say first and foremost, one of the challenges of reviewing the record of Judge Gorsuch is that you didn't have a lot of cases in the areas that instinctively people would look at, right? So there are no cases that we were able to find in which Judge Gorsuch ruled on the Voting Rights Act, right, or affirmative action, or any of the kind of more traditional areas that we were able to look at with, let's say, a Justice Alito. So it really required a much deeper look at his record in some other areas to understand the way in which they would apply to civil rights. Now, it's not that he has no civil rights record. He has some very troubling decisions in the area of LGBTQ equality, troubling decisions around women and contraception, without question. But in terms of the core race and civil rights issues, so he didn't have a record in some of those areas. Now, he did have a record on employment discrimination cases, and we were deeply concerned about that record. We're deeply concerned about the record in cases involving excessive force and police violence. Judge Gorsuch was part of an opinion in 2013 in which the court granted immunity to a police officer who shot and killed a 22-year-old in the head with a taser, someone who was unarmed and who was not regarded as violent. He was a marijuana grower, and he was running away from police officers. And the panel that Judge Gorsuch sat on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, granted immunity to that police officer. The next year, they granted immunity. He was on a panel that granted police immunity to a police officer who broke the collarbone of a 9-year-old who was accused of stealing an iPad in school. And when the police officer arrived, the 9-year-old was sitting calmly on the floor with the principal and a teacher. And the police officer came and ordered the 9-year-old to get up and said, "We can do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way," and grabbed the 9-year-old in a twist and lock, which twists your arm back. And when the 9-year-old put out her other hand to kind of, really stop this terrible pain, the officer broke the collarbone of the 9-year-old. Again, qualified immunity. So we had a number of those kinds of cases that we were concerned about. And then we were concerned about the way in which Judge Gorsuch very often rules in favor of ending a case before litigants have an opportunity to have their day in court, which is particularly important for those who are bringing civil rights suits. And then, of course, areas in which he reaches out to change what he thinks or to describe what he thinks should be a changed legal standard. If I had to pick a judge who was going to be an activist on the Supreme Court, this would be the one. He has very specific ideas about the direction he wants the law to go in. And if I could describe one, and just be patient with me because it's going to sound wonky, and this is what I mean about why he was a difficult case, but it's really important. So there's a doctrine called the Chevron doctrine. It arises from a case with the name Chevron from the early 1980s. And in that case, the Supreme Court found that what courts should do, federal courts should do, is they should defer to a federal agency's interpretation of their obligations. So in other words, their federal courts will look at, as they did several years ago, the way in which HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, has determined what their obligations are under using the disparate impact standard of housing discrimination, or they'll defer to the EPA on pollution standards. Even Justice Scalia thought that was the right thing to do, that agencies have developed an expertise that that should be recognized, an expertise that certainly outweighs the expertise of judges. And yet Judge Garland determined last year that not only does he not think that agencies are not automatically entitled to deference, but that he would, it was clear, overturn that Chevron decision. He could go further than Justice Scalia and suggest that courts should not defer to agencies. Now, what that means for a variety of areas that we care about, you know, whether, as I said, we're talking about fair housing and segregation, whether we're talking about Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits employment discrimination, whether we're talking about Title IX, which requires equal funding for girls' sports and boys' sports in school, a whole series of statutes that are interpreted by agencies, and that for 30 years the court has deferred to that interpretation. Judge Gorsuch thinks courts shouldn't do that. So it sounds wonky, but when you think about the effect of it, it's a sweeping effect that it would be very hard for people to recognize in this moment, but when it's happening, they'll see the extraordinary effect on many of the guarantees that we have come to expect over the years.
So it's a couple of things interesting here, but let me throw two of them out. I mean, one is this whole description you're talking about a minister of law. I mean, this also fits in a political sense hand in hand with the philosophy of Steve Bannon, who is in some ways pushing policy and could very well have pushed the nomination of a man like Mr. Gorsuch, Judge Gorsuch, because the part of their idea is to destroy the administrative state. not allow that to take place. You can see what they're doing with the EPA, what they're threatening to do with the Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Justice. And now this, I mean, because it fits a political pattern, it seems to me.
Well, I have to say that's one of the disturbing, will we know? I don't know, but it is disturbing. President Trump had essentially outsourced to two conservative organizations, the Heritage Foundation and the American Enterprise Institute, the job of coming up with a list of names of judges who would be eligible to be nominated by him to the United States Supreme Court. And Judge Gorsuch wasn't on that original list, of 21 judges that the different agencies had put forward. But then you see these very conservative decisions that you've talked about that line up with this vision of deconstructing the administrative state that Steve Bannon, who is the chief strategist to the president and who was the publisher of the white supremacist publication Breitbart, that's part of his that's kind of his goal. And so there is that, and that's part of why the Senate members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, that certainly the Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, have been focusing on whether or not whether Judge Gorsuch is really independent of the administration. Remember, when he was nominated, Rentz Priebus, who is the other strategist to the president and former head of the Republican Party, said that Judge Gorsuch has the vision of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has made clear that his vision is that whoever he nominated for the Supreme Court has to be prepared to overturn Roe versus Wade. And we know that his vision of the court, especially based on how he's executed the Muslim ban and his criticism of judges and so forth, is very unique and very particular. So the question is, why would he pick Judge Gorsuch if he didn't think that Judge Gorsuch lined up with his views, especially when Rentz Priebus says that Judge Gorsuch has the vision of Donald Trump? And at one point during the hearing, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island really asked about that, and he pointed out that the extreme right is spending $10 million on television ads and other buys to support the confirmation of Judge Gorsuch. And Sheldon Whitehouse said they must think they're going to get what they're paying for, right? So why is it that they all believe that you are in this same mold, and yet you sit here before us and tell us that you are independent and you can't be, no one can speak for you but you? I sat in the hearing the first 2 days. It's really quite interesting to see the way in which Judge Gorsuch was creating, an image of himself that he expected the committee to accept.
And what's an interesting twist here, you mentioned the Chevron case during the Reagan administration. I mean, that involved his mother. And
well,
Gorsuch,
one of the things I've chosen not to do is to get into the issue of Ann Gorsuch, his mother, who served in the Reagan administration and had to leave office under a cloud, in part because I don't think kids are responsible for whatever mistakes
absolutely not.
Their parents may make. However, I do think that, and I've shied away from it because I have really tried to focus people on his record. There's so many ways to be distressed about this particular nominee, right? You can be distressed about him simply because he has even been nominated and is getting got a hearing, considering what happened to Judge Garland. You can be distressed about him because this nomination and a confirmation hearing happens under the cloud of a president who's being investigated by the FBI for and his campaign being investigated by the FBI. And so there are questions of legitimacy. There's so many different ways to come at this, and when you think you add them all up, if you put those two together, then with his actual record, it seems clear to me that it's shocking to imagine that under these conditions and with a candidate with this record, we would be moving towards confirmation.
So, and while there are no clear-cut cases you described earlier that have to do with civil rights, especially voting rights and more, though we both understand that that's taking place as we speak, that conversation, though he won't answer it, I'm sure, no matter how much he's pushed. In your report, you did cover access to justice.
Which, you know, so that's what I said. Yeah. So I don't want to leave the impression that there's no civil rights record, right? I'm saying that you know, in the hot button issues that we would tend to think about, you know, and some of that is because of the 10th Circuit. If you think about the cases of the states that are part of the 10th Circuit, the circuit where he's in a federal appellate judge, it's Kansas, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah. These are places with a fairly low African American population. So and not part of the South. So you're not going to find a lot of the more traditional civil rights battles that you would think about. But it doesn't mean he doesn't have a civil rights record. You know, that's why we wrote a 70-page report, and you hit on one of the most important ones: access to justice. And this is the closing the courthouse door before people have a chance to litigate their cases. And probably lots of your listeners have had that experience before they have a chance to do discovery. And especially when you're dealing with issues of civil rights and discrimination, you know, people are not leaving hanging around on the desk of their offices evidence that they engaged in discrimination. You have to get into the litigation and do discovery. You have to subpoena testimony, and you have to pull together demand documents and review documents and really engage in a searching inquiry to be able to prove your discrimination claim. But what we saw in Judge Gorsuch's record was his willingness to allow claims to be dismissed at a very early stage before the parties even have a chance to do discovery. And that suggests that you don't understand actually the nature of civil rights violations. You don't understand the nature of discrimination. It's almost like the Lilly Ledbetter case, you know, years ago when Justice Ginsburg talked about, you know, why a woman wouldn't know she was being paid less than a man. These are not, you know, pieces of evidence that are just laying around. And yet Judge Gorsuch has shown a tremendous kind of coldness and technical adherence to his interpretation of the rules in a way that has really closed the courthouse door to the people who need it the most.
So as a lawyer, and as I think one of the keenest legal minds we have, as president and director of counsel of the Legal Defense Fund, I wonder if you think that we're moving into a different era here. I mean, since the 1950s, a lot of the progress we made in civil rights and even the environment, workers' rights, voting rights, was done through or at least upheld by the courts, right? So are we about to enter into an era now where we don't rely on the courts as much in our battles?
Interesting. That's so interesting, Mark, because in fact, I would say just the opposite.
Okay.
If you look at what has happened since January 20th, where we have seen breakdowns, you know, over and even before, you know, in so many of the major institutions in our country. I think last year we saw real failings in the media, you know, the Fourth Estate, one of the most important institutions in any democracy. I think the media is fighting its way back, thankfully, this year and has been maybe perhaps mollified by the experience of last year. But we saw the challenges to the media. We've seen that Congress, you know, the challenges to Congress. We just talked about this at the top of the segment and talking about Senator Mitch McConnell, the willingness to violate the rules, the willingness to undermine, you know, the democratic process, and the willingness to undermine the ability of the executive, in this case, President Obama, to be able to do his job. The reason that President Obama had to use executive orders is because he had a Republican-controlled Congress who would not come to the table. They wouldn't even come to the table to talk because everything that they were about was about seeing to it that he was defeated and trying to humiliate him. So you've seen all of that, and then since January 20th, what you've seen is that the one institution that at least thus far has remained strong are the courts, is the legal system. And so when people get excited about the ACLU's litigation, you know, challenging the Muslim ban as well as other organizations, or my organization, LDF's work challenging voter ID laws, and we've been winning in all of those cases, you know, the ACLU and others winning in the Muslim ban cases, LDF winning in the challenges to Texas voter ID. These are all areas in which the courts have been vindicating our rights. This has been the one place where we've been able to get a fair hearing. And so I actually think this is law time. This is the time when law is really important, especially when we have an administration in the White House that doesn't care about ethics, that doesn't care about norms. I mean, this is a week in which the president's daughter is setting up an office in the West Wing of the White House with a you know, security clearance and a government phone, even though she has no job, right? So this is a White House willing to violate norms and ethics. Law is critically important. And I'm proud, really, just of how civil rights legal organizations have been standing up in the courts since January 20th and showing, you know, how strong we're going to stand. For us, it's really important because the Attorney General is now Jeff Sessions, and we can't really count on the Department of Justice to be the kind of aggressive enforcer of the nation's civil rights laws that we came to expect under Attorney General Holder and Attorney General Lynch and others. And so we feel that we have to really stand up and be a kind of private Department of Justice and really use the courts in the areas that are being abandoned by the Justice Department today.
That's a really interesting analysis. I mean, I think that that makes a great deal of sense. But the more that they appoint conservative justices and judges, that's why I was positing that perhaps we're in a moment where a political push has
this moment and this moment and this moment, right? So
right.
At this moment, right, I would say, you know, the courts, you know, are on our side, including, you know, including the Supreme Court, which only has 8 justices at this moment. But you're right. What looms large is that there are 120 or so vacant seats on the federal bench. And as it currently stands, those seats will be available for Mr. Trump to fill. And so the court may undergo a pretty serious transformation over the next few years if they are successful in pushing through conservative judges to sit on those courts. That means you won't need necessarily Judge Gorsuch to do it in the Supreme Court. You won't get your hearing in the trial court, you know, because you're going to have very conservative federal district court judges who may not have an amenable ear to civil rights cases. So I think, you know, we're both right. I think I'm right in that at this moment, the courts have been showing themselves to be an important bulwark against the excesses of President Trump. But I think that we all worry that in the future, as the Trump administration is able to appoint additional judges, including justices on the Supreme Court, that window may close.
So, I mean, one of the things, I know you have to run, but one of the last thing here is that we have, I mean, I think there's a huge judicial and political struggle ahead of us here. I mean, you've seen the pushback. I mean, as the NAACP has written, Legal Defense Fund, as you wrote in your letter that came out of that report, this judicial activism is on from the conservative end of the spectrum has been really powerful in pushing back voting rights and more challenging everything. We're in the midst of a struggle. To me, that is not unlike what we faced in 1878. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's like there's a
Mark. You are absolutely spot on. And I really am glad you're saying it because I don't want anyone to underestimate or to underplay the peril of this moment. This is about as serious as it gets. And we can't lie to ourselves and we can't pretend that we are not facing the challenge that we're facing. This is, you know, this is a very, very serious moment for this entire country, for this democracy, not just for Black people, you know. And so if ever there was a time to be engaged and involved, this is the time. Here's the thing I think is interesting. If we come through this, and there's no guarantee we get through this, you know, with our institutions in place and some measure of justice and equality, you know, present, but assuming we do, assuming we're resilient enough to do so, when we get to the other side of this, we may end up being the better for it. Because I think people understand now that, you know, citizenship is a responsibility. It requires your action. It requires that you stay engaged. It requires that you speak. It requires that you not just vote, you know, in the presidential election, but that you vote for every office. It requires that you show up at school board meetings. It requires that you pay attention to what the county commission is doing and what your city council members are doing. That even if you think you live in a state that you think is amenable, that you're calling your Congress people, that you're paying attention. And if that's the message that's being conveyed around the country, that we can no longer sleepwalk our way through and expect that progress is going to just happen. Progress is not inevitable. It constantly has to be pushed. And for those of us who are the beneficiaries of the sacrifice and the, you know, the devastation that our forebears confronted and faced and overcame so that we could have even the measure of freedom that we have now, we better wake up and realize what our responsibilities are. And if we come out of this with that renewed sense of purpose and with that renewed sense of our responsibility and obligation, we may be in a better position to really move forward the needle of equality, to move forward justice, to deal with, tackle really racism, to really tackle the criminal justice system, to really tackle economic opportunity, to really tackle our education system in a way that is clear and, you know, premised on the idea of equal justice, premised on the idea of opportunity, premised on the idea that Black people are full citizens of this country and must be full citizens of this country, and that citizenship has to have real meaning in this country, then we may be the better. And that's, you know, I try to keep that in my head as I engage in these battles that sometimes seem quite disappointing and in some instances overwhelming.
And I do agree with that sentiment and that analysis. I mean, I think the overwhelming majority of people in this country are moving in the right direction. And I think that's what we have to rely on and push and really fight for right now as well, courts and in the community. So, Shel Knight, it was always an inspiration to talk to you. I deeply appreciate the time that you've given us. I know how busy your schedule is. Eiffel is the president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and has joined us here on the Mark Steiner Show. Shel, thank you so much once again.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.